Well, good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's program, The Resource Curse, Oil's Impact on the Countries and People Who Produce It. Joining us this evening is Peter Maas, distinguished author and writer for the New York Times Magazine. I'm Robert Collier, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for Environmental Public Policy, and I'm honored to be your moderator. I'd like to acknowledge the Asia Society and the Mechanics Institute Library, who are co-sponsoring tonight's program. So a quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, please visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by listening to the podcasts and streaming audio and video online at the website. And if you'd like to re-listen to this evening's remarks, I would encourage you to make use of this great collection. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show, It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Tonight's program is being recorded for future broadcast, and I would like to thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Lastly, I'd like to remind you to use the blue comment cards, question cards that are in your seats, and please pass them over to council staff. We'll be circulating around, and the questions will be posed to Mr. Maas in the second half of the program. And obviously, it would be greatly appreciated if everybody turned off their cell phones and anything else that might disturb the program. So, it is my distinct honor to introduce Peter Maas. He began writing for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune in 1985, covering NATO and the European Union. In 87, he moved to Seoul, South Korea, where he wrote primarily for the Washington Post. After three more years in Asia, he moved to Budapest, Hungary, to cover Eastern Europe and the Balkans, where he spent most of 92 and 93 covering the war in Bosnia. In 96, he published Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, a book chronicling his experiences covering the Bosnian conflict, which won the LA Times Book Prize and the Overseas Press Club Book Prize. Mr. Maas now lives in New York City, where he is a contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine. His newest book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, was released earlier this month. So he is here to discuss the far-reaching impacts of oil. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Maas.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming here. The most important thing, first off, can everybody hear me okay? Terrific. Okay. I want to start off, obviously, by thanking the World Affairs Council and Rob for inviting me here, having me here. This is kind of a homecoming for me because I'm a UC Berkeley grad. It's been a while, obviously, but it is a great honor and delight to be back here. And I also want to just mention my sister is here, so thank her, and also just make you all aware that that means my mother's going to get a detailed report on how things go here. So be gentle. I want to talk about oil, but a property of it that we often don't associate with it, which is invisibility. I mean, oil is everywhere. It's in our gas tanks. We know it's a big deal. But I was kind of intrigued by it because I thought there are a lot of parts of it that actually we don't know about that we don't see. I mean, we know, of course, that, you know, oil is a fossil fuel. It causes damage to, in terms of global warming. But there were other problems that I saw in terms of the effect that oil has on some of the countries that supply it to us that I realized that really hadn't been kind of dealt with in a way that I wanted to see them dealt with. And so after I wrote this book about the war in Bosnia, which was really a book about kind of the epiphenomenon of war. I was in the middle of this war, being shot at. People around me were being shot at. I described it. I wanted to write something, a book, about causes of war, causes of poverty, causes of conflict, causes of wealth. And oil kind of struck me very quickly as the right subject, not just because it is talked about so much, but that also there's a lot of kind of myths and things that are unknown. I mean, when I was in Bosnia, Bosnians would say to me, if only we had oil, America would come save us. And then, of course, you know, in the Middle East, people were saying, my God, if only we didn't have oil, we wouldn't be invaded, etc. And I kind of wanted to find out for myself, well, what is the truth? How does oil operate? And the problem is that I realize this is an incredible kind of opportunity, but a challenge, because oil is just this black liquid. I'm not really writing about this black liquid. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a chemist. I'm writing about all these things around it that happen as a result of it. But I couldn't figure out as a kind of narrative writer, because I was most interested in writing a book that would have a story that people would read so they'd understand oil, so that I could understand oil. How do you do that as a writer? How do you bring it alive? How do you tell a story about a substance? And initially, in 2001, I started this project. And I started it with the idea that, aha, the way that I'm going to bring oil alive and tell its story is by getting jobs in the oil industry. And I was kind of under the influence at the time of a great book that was written by Ted Conover called New Jack, where he worked for a year as a prison corrections officer at Sing Sing. And then he wrote this fabulous book from the inside about what it was like to be a prison corrections officer, what it was like inside of a prison. So I thought, great, I'll do the same thing with oil. I'll get a job swabbing the decks of oil tankers. I'll go get a job, if I can, in the mailroom of Halliburton. And I'll go, as I did in 2001, the spring of 2001, to Lafayette, Louisiana, and try to get a job as a roughneck. And as you can see, this is not roughneck material. And it led to kind of a comedy unto itself, where I would go in for these for interviews. I went in interviews in one case where they bring in these companies kind of like 12 wannabe roughnecks at a time, sit you around a table, and you know, you fill out a little application form, and a recruiter asks you one question, and then you're out the door. And I get into this room with these a dozen other wannabe roughnecks, and you know, it's very clear that I'm the one, or the only one, who has showered in 2 months, and who has a full set of teeth, and then it also becomes clear the recruiter in this one case, Neighbors is the name of the company, goes around the table asking people questions, and then he gets to me, and he looks at my application form, he looks at me and he says, University of California, Berkeley? Because there weren't a lot of college graduates in the room. And then the next thing he says is, do you work for one of the unions? Because he assumed that I was a union spy. So I didn't get that job, and I didn't get any job as a roughneck, which is all for the better, actually, because quite seriously, if anybody here has worked in the oil fields, it's incredibly dangerous work, and it's no place for amateurs like me. What I realized is that, okay, this is not going to work, this strategy. How am I going to bring oil alive? How am I going to write about it? And very fortunately, at about that same time, oil became very central in a way that it hadn't been. After 9/11, of course, with the invasion of Iraq coming up, oil became a big subject. But I was still kind of faced with the same problem. Okay, big subject. It's all breaking out all over the place. And I kind of described this dilemma at the very beginning of the book, and this is the only reading I'm probably going to subject you to here, and it's just a few sentences. How do you coax secrets from a liquid? To know a person, you talk to him. To know a country, you visit it. To know a religion, you study sacred texts. Oil defies these norms of interrogation. It's a commodity that is extracted, refined, shipped, and poured into your gas tank with few people seeing it. It has no voice, body, army, or dogma of its own. It's invisible most of the time, but like gravity, it influences everything we do. And so I begin in 2003 reporting this book in a conventional way. I go to all of these countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Venezuela, Russia, Nigeria, Ecuador, Equatorial Guinea. And I go as deeply as I can finding people whose lives have been shaped by oil. And in these countries, everybody's life has been shaped by oil. And I try to kind of bring alive everything I see, describe it very kind of particularly and viscerally in order to kind of make it a story so that people may read it, so that it's compelling. And so what happens when you go to these countries, when I went to these countries, is that really almost immediately, because they are all centered around oil, oil would kind of drench me in terms of people's lives. I went to Nigeria. And Nigeria is a country that has 40 billion barrels of oil or so, a major supplier to the United States. Since the 1960s, when it began exporting oil, it's earned about $400 billion in royalties from it. It's also an example, Nigeria, of what is often called kind of the curse of oil, because Nigeria, despite having all this oil, despite having earned all this money from oil, 80% of the population today is at or below poverty level. One out of five children die before they reach the age of five. The country has a corruption culture that is kind of off the scales, and there's a war going on in Nigeria. And it's not the usual kind of war of country against country. It's not even a war like in Iraq, where there's like a clear insurgency of sorts and a government that it's fighting against. It's happening in the Delta. So I wanted to go into the Delta. Not because I didn't know at all what was happening, but because my purpose was to try to bring alive to people here this price of oil that we don't see in the countries, some of them, that supply it to us. And in order to do this, I went to Port Harcourt, which is the largest city in the Niger Delta region. And this is kind of a manifestation of just how kind of complex things were in Nigeria. I didn't need the permission of the government to go into the Delta, which is kind of like the Florida Everglades, but with oil facilities and a little war going on. I needed the permission of the major warlord at the time, whose name was Mujahid Asari Dokubo. And in order to get his permission, there was a truce at the time, which made it very convenient for me. I visited him as a hotel in Port Harcourt. And it was one of these kind of funny, strange experiences where I go to his hotel, meet him in his hotel room, and I put my digital voice recorder kind of between us. And he looks at it, and he's like, oh, that is wonderful, I want that. And, you know, what do you say? I explained to him, I need that because I want to go into the Delta and tell the story, and, you know, you can get one on the internet. And he's very sophisticated, and he's like, oh, of course, that's right, okay, I'll do that. And the next day, he assigns one of his aides to go with me into the Delta. And it was a journey that was kind of into the surreal, and I try to, you know, bring it alive as much as possible in the book, where we drive for 2 hours to the end of a road, get in a canoe that has a little outboard motor, and start going up the creeks. And kind of almost immediately, it becomes a vision out of, you know, Mad Max or Waterworld. There's a lot of oil there, and there are a lot of oil facilities, and they're all kind of surrounded by troops because there's this war going on, and the government and the companies basically kind of control the territory where their oil facilities are, but the rest of it is kind of in the control of the local people. So we go up these creeks, and because it's such a chaotic situation, you have practices, environmental practices, that would not be allowed here in America and have not been allowed here for quite a long time. You have natural gas that comes out of the ground along with the oil, and it was just being kind of flared liberally. So the earth on the sides of the creeks, in some cases, were just kind of flaring gas, flaring flames. There were pits of oil that were just kind of burning alight. We stop at a village where the army had launched an attack a few weeks previous, and before that there had been a fight between two militias over this village, and the only people there were wounded survivors, one of whom kind of came up to us in the canoe before we really even landed, and he said, you can't come here, you know, even though he was a member of the militia that was controlled by the warlord who gave me permission to travel there. He was so mad at his own warlord, who was living in Port Harcourt safely, that he didn't want me or the person I was with to even get into the village. And this was kind of a demonstration of this kind of, you know, very nasty everyone against everyone else, in a sense, anarchic situation that exists in this territory that has the oil. Eventually he showed us around, and, you know, kind of strangely and weirdly, he's showing us around, and the injury he had recently suffered was, in this fight that had happened a few weeks previous, is that he lost his right hand, and it was bandaged. It was a very kind of soiled bandage, and he would be pointing out, you know, look, this building was burned, and, you know, this one somebody was killed in, with his arm that had no hand. We get back into the canoe, and then we go up further, and we end up at this village called Oro Sangoma. And this was a village that kind of was your picture of third world destitution, in the sense of no running water, no electricity, no health care. The first thing you kind of feel and smell when you arrive is this kind of fecal stench from the fact that this the latrine is the creek itself. Right across from this village is a Shell facility. So you have this village, total destitution, and the oil facility, and these are the way they are throughout the Delta, it's totally first world. I mean, it's surrounded by troops, it's got an electrified fence, but then there's like manicured lawns, and then you have these facilities and administration buildings with electricity, air conditioning, Wi-Fi connections, cafeterias, etc. And it was kind of the most, you know, in-your-face kind of example of how we, who are the beneficiaries of the oil that Shell takes out of this area, benefit from it, quite obviously. But the people right there do not. And they suffer from it, because also at this facility, there's this these massive flares that are going up, again, the natural gas that comes up. And it's incredibly unhealthy to flare natural gas because lots of chemicals and toxins are released. And these people were living 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, under these flares. The only illumination they had at night was this kind of Martian glow from the flares. And, you know, great, they had light. You know, the light was killing them virtually. And it was always very strange to be going around this village, to be welcomed into it, because, you know, as a foreigner who was with a deputy of the warlord, I was welcomed there. And you end up in these very strange situations that kind of show you just how connected we are in ways you don't expect, because I'm arrived there, and they take me to their kind of little community hut, open-air hut, and they have a generator, and they have a satellite dish, and they have a TV, all of which they turn on. And the first thing I know, I'm watching Fox News in the middle of the Niger Delta, and I'm thinking, like, well, this is good, they're connected to the world, but, you know, everything they know about it, apparently, is from Bill O'Reilly's lips. And if it were just Jon Stewart, it would also be similarly narrow and disturbing in perhaps different ways. And, you know, the king, the tribal leader was referred to as the king, takes me around the next day in his canoe, and you know, he's pointing out the pollution on the water. If I had lit a match and thrown it on the water, you know, we could have had a little fire there. And we passed by a little island where, which was called Little Russia. And it was just a little island where there were these women living there, and they were prostitutes who were there for the oil workers and for the army soldiers. And so the tribal chieftain, the king, King Tom Mercy, just shows this to me, and he shows me these wellheads, which is kind of the oil's coming out, and it emerges through these pipes that are then kind of connected to facilities on the ground, and they're just dripping oil into the water, which, you know, here in America and other places would just not be allowed. It's happening there. And he just says to me, you know, you see how we live. And so I try in the book to just make this as real as possible. You know, I don't think I'm breaking ground in kind of going to Nigeria and seeing this conflict. But what I try to do as a writer, it, with kind of words and imagination, is bring it home, bring it here to people here, because the headlines don't explain it. They don't sink in. They don't stay with you. And I try to write things that stay with people about oil, about what it does. And so I tried to do this with every country I went to, and I really kind of like do an incredible injustice to Tolstoy by stealing one of his best lines and saying that, you know, every dysfunctional oil country is dysfunctional in its own way. So you have Nigeria, which is an example of particular conditions. I went to Equatorial Guinea nearby, also West Africa, tiny country, about 500,000 people, which discovered oil recently, just in the 1990s. And Equatorial Guinea is ruled by Teodoro Obiang, who's been in power for about 30 years and who quite famously came to power by staging a coup against his uncle, whom he then executed. So just going back to Tolstoy, if you think you have a dysfunctional family, this one tops yours, I think. The last election, Equatorial Guinea, the ruling party, Obiang's ruling party, won 97% of the vote. He's regarded as one of the worst dictators in the world, usually makes the top 10 lists. The first several hundred million dollars of oil revenues that his government got were put in secret bank accounts, actually here in America, under his personal control. So I went there to kind of follow the money and find out the conditions there. And I lasted for 8 days. And on the eighth day, I was expelled and accused of being a spy. And I'm telling this story here not because it's, I mean, it is about me, but the reason I'm telling it is because actually it's about oil. Because what happened is that after 8 days of going around talking to people, finding out about the regime, the government, and what happened or wasn't happening with all the oil money, the information minister begins calling me and texting me saying, I must see you now. And in a country like this, when the information minister says, I must see you now, you kind of know what's going to happen. So we met on the balcony or patio of a hotel, and he says, the president himself is upset with you. You have to leave the country. You're being expelled. We argued a little bit, but there was obviously no budging there. He had an aide with him who took me to my hotel. I had 15 minutes to pack my bags. I was taken to the airport. And then the minister comes to the airport when I'm in the departure lounge. And now the minister is absolutely furious. And he's shouting, you're a spy. We know you're a spy. We're going to take you downtown for an interrogation. And in a country like this, you don't want to be interrogated. It's not good. It's one of the worst human rights records in the world. And He then starts, he demands that I open my bags for inspection again so that he can inspect them. I start unzipping my backpack, and it's too slow for him, and he starts slapping my arms. And I know that things are getting out of control. And so I then say something which stopped him dead in his tracks, and it's related to oil, because I just said to him, look, if you touch me again, and if you take me downtown for an interrogation, your president will never go to Washington again, and the United States of America is going to be very upset with you and your president. And this was like I'd hit him with a stun gun. He stopped. And the reason he stopped is because the companies that are extracting all the oil and natural gas from Equatorial Guinea, from its waters, are American for the most part. Several billion dollars have been sunken into that country by American companies. Obiang has visited Washington. Condoleezza Rice called him a good friend. And Obiang is a dictator, like all dictators, is afraid. Somebody's going to unseat him. Somebody locally, maybe a foreign government. There have been coup attempts against him. And he didn't want to risk. The minister knew that his president won't want to risk that relationship. He needed it. He needed American support. And so the minister didn't know whether I was bluffing or not. I was obviously bluffing. I have no idea if the American government would care what happened to me. I know my mother, my stepmother, my sister would care. But, you know, George W. Bush or Barack Obama, I don't know. He didn't know, however, the minister. And he just said, get out of here. Threw stuff back in my bags, and I was on the next plane out of Cameroon. And this was a reminder, a really strong kind of reminder, and an uncomfortable one, of what we do for oil and the compromises we make, because I was saved by oil in that sense. You know, America's relationship with Obiang, because of his oil, gave me the power to say, don't touch me, I'm an American. Good for me. But the problem is, because America is such a close ally of that government, the people can't say the same thing to Obiang. And they can't say, you know, don't touch us because America's going to be mad at you, because they know America won't be mad at him. And so we have this relationship with Obiang, and 97% of the votes, allegedly, are for his ruling party. And it continues. And we have these kinds of relationships in so many other places. And so I try to write about that from this, you know, ground-up perspective. And I try to do it in different places. I went to Iraq, and it was the same kind of situation where, you know, I want to go there and learn what I can and hopefully kind of see how oil shapes things. And so in 2003, my editors at the Times Magazine say, there's this invasion coming up. Why don't you cover it for us? And I agree to go to Kuwait City, and I become one of these crazy journalists in March of 2003 who goes to Kuwait City, goes to the Hertz office and rents a rental SUV that I then, on March 18th, the first day of the invasion, drive through what perhaps was a landmine field into Iraq. And I follow a battalion of Marines to Baghdad. And 3 weeks later, the battalion of Marines that I had just kind of glommed onto were the ones that took down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square. Rob was also there that day because he had been in Baghdad throughout. We can maybe talk about some of this in the question and answer session. And we all know the images, you know, the flag on the statue of Saddam, the Iraqis slapping the face of Saddam that had been taken down from the statue afterwards. But it was also an incredibly chaotic period. There was all this looting going on, and it was very confusing. And I was kind of like, I was there, I was thinking like, okay, now I'm going to get the clarity about oil and war and politics, but it was confusing. It seemed like victory, statue comes down. But in that square, there was one Iraqi was pointed out as being, by somebody said, a spy for Saddam, and a bunch of other Iraqis immediately tried to beat him up, and an American Marine had to intervene to stop it. And then I went out the next day driving around, and it's just chaos. It's anarchy. There's looting going on. It's dangerous to leave the Palestine Hotel. And you know, I go to the oil ministry. And amidst all the looting, the burning, the flames, the oil ministry is surrounded by American troops, somewhat famously. And I go there. It's the only kind of area of calm. And there are some Iraqis who work in the ministry who are trying to get in, or who want to get in. They work there. And they couldn't get in. And they like were just tugging on my sleeve, saying, look, you know, the National Museum is being looted. The only place that's being protected is the Ministry of Oil. It's all about oil. And one of the things about kind of the invisibility of oil and that we don't kind of take account of all the things that go on is that sometimes because it's not clear to us what is happening on the other side of the pipeline, we focus on just one thing, or the most dramatic thing, and indeed the oil ministry was the only thing that was surrounded. But I went across the river in the subsequent days to the main oil refinery for Baghdad, the Dora oil refinery. And there, actually, in the first few days after the Americans had arrived in Baghdad, there was no protection of it. The refinery director, this guy named Dattar Hashab, who is this kind of rascal of a Ba'athist, because he was a member of the party, but it turned out he loved his refinery more than he loved Saddam, had to organize his own workers, find some AK-47s, whatever, to hold off the looters who were trying to attack the refinery. A couple days after the statue fell, some American soldiers arrive, and a few of them are assigned to help defend the refinery. And then I arrive, and the kind of captain who's in charge is this 82nd Airborne Ranger named Tom Huff. And so I stay at the refinery and to write a story about them and see what's happening. And I what I see is that there is no planning to protect this refinery. And a lot of other oil facilities in Iraq were also unprotected. And this 82nd Airborne Captain, Tom Huff, not only has to try to defend the refinery with the 30 or 40 troops that he has, he also has to get supplies for it to make it operate. He also has to kind of like mediate over labor disputes that were breaking out over who should be the new management, etc. And like almost every day that I was there, he would just kind of smack his head and he would say to me, you know, I don't know, nobody trained me to do this. You know, I'm an airborne soldier. I am trained to jump out of planes and kill people. But I am here running a refinery. What's going on? And what it showed to me was that, well, wait a minute. You know, I remembered in 1990-91 with the Persian Gulf War, you know, within 100 days of Saddam's troops being pushed out of Kuwait, even though all of the Kuwaiti oil fields, or many of them, were left in flames, the flames were out and oil began to flow again, because that war was 100% about oil. But the more I kind of spent time in Iraq, I saw, aha, you know, it's greatly about oil, but there are other things, perhaps, because if it was about oil, or just about oil, then the Dora refinery probably would have been protected. You know, the mid-level American official who was the first one to arrive in Baghdad, a former Exxon executive named Gary Vogler, he didn't arrive until like 2 or 3 weeks after the statue of Saddam Hussein fell down. And I talked with him and tried to arrange to really sit down and have a deep interview with him, and I realized it's very difficult to arrange it because he didn't have his own satellite phone, he didn't have his own vehicle, and I realized I, with my own satellite phone and my own vehicle, was kind of better equipped than the first civilian American who was to come here to oversee Iraq's oil industry. And so kind of what I learned from this was the question isn't whether a war is about oil, but how it's about oil. And that there can be oil as a central factor, but other factors too. I also tried to find out about the money flow. The problem with oil, in terms of like how it can have negative effects on countries, is of course is that so much of the transactions are secret. Contract negotiations tend to be secret. The amounts of money, generally speaking, might be known, but the precise amounts, when they're paid, to whom they're paid in the countries that receive them, what happens with the money once it gets there, it's very secret. And so the way I tried to bring this alive, because if you're just talking about transactions and secret transactions, et cetera, it can become very difficult narratively to make it real, is I wanted to speak with a guy named Jim Giffen. And Jim Giffen was the right-hand man of the Kazakh president during the 1990s. He's an American oilman who became friendly with the Kazakh president and negotiated on Kazakhstan's behalf major multi-billion oil deals. In 2003, he was arrested at John F. Kennedy Airport by federal prosecutors on bribery charges, accused of $80 million in bribery, taking money from the oil companies, putting it in his own pocket and sharing it with his unindicted co-conspirator who was the president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev. Now, I wanted to talk to Giffen, but it's very difficult, obviously, to talk with somebody who's just been indicted for $80 million in bribery. But one of the things about trying to report out a subject like this is that I end up doing a lot of things that just lead absolutely nowhere. But every so often, something that seems like it's going to lead nowhere leads somewhere. So I went to the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan to attend a process hearing for Giffen's case. This is a couple of years ago. I got there early because I was thinking, like, well, Giffen will get there early, and I'll just try to introduce myself and say, like, let's talk. So I get there. Elevator doors open. There's Giffen. sitting there in his very nice jacket and suit with his four lawyers who were sitting there in very nice jackets and suit. And I go up to him and I introduce myself and I say, Peter Moss, New York Times, and I'm writing a book about oil and the industry and I really want to talk to you about what goes on. And he looks at me and the first thing he says is, well, are you also writing about what the governments are doing? And I say, yes, yes, of course. And then his lawyers immediately kind of realize, oh my God, my client is talking with a journalist. And they say, you know, they stand up and say, you can't talk with our client. And they look at Giff and say, well, don't talk to him. But then I call the lawyers a couple of days later and say, look, you know, I really want to talk to your client, and I know that he's under indictment, and it's difficult for him to talk, but we can talk off the record. And they say, no, he's not going to talk to you. I say, just tell him I want to talk to him, and here's some clips. Email them to the lawyers. And they say, okay, fine, we'll send it to him. But, and then 2 weeks later, my phone rings, and I pick it up, and the voice on the other end says, this is Jim Giffen, and this conversation is not happening. And I say, yes, it is, and it isn't. And we talk for a couple of hours. And it's off the record. And I'm telling you about this here because eventually he agreed to go on record with some of this, and it's in the book. And he invites me to his office, and I go to his office several times. He was arrested and put in jail, and he posted $10 million in bail the next morning. He's been out ever since. I know, we should all be so lucky to be able to post bail quite like that. And I go to his office, and in his office, there are pictures of him with virtually every American president going back to, and including, if my memory serves me correctly, Richard Nixon. And the thing that he tells me is, look, you know, I was an American, the right-hand man of the Kazakh president who controls all of this oil, and I was negotiating contracts that American companies got. Why are you blaming me for this? Why am I being indicted? And the fascinating thing is that the reason he hasn't come to trial yet 6 years later is because of his defense. And this goes back to the first thing that he said to me. His defense is what's called a public authority defense, which is that he was working for the CIA. And that if you're working for the government, one branch of the government, then you can't, and it knows what you're doing, transferring money, taking a little bit here, sharing it with the president, you can't be prosecuted for that. And it sounds like a remarkable plot out of Syriana or something like that, if you've seen it. And in fact, there's a famous scene in Syriana, this movie about oil, where a kind of sleazy lawyer, or seems to be sleazy lawyer, says to another one who's pretending not to be sleazy and who's complaining about bribery and corruption, this guy says, you know, corruption, you know, why are you talking to me about corruption? Corruption is why you and I aren't, you know, fighting over sticks and animal carcasses outdoors. Corruption is what keeps us warm. Corruption is why we win. And Giffen was the model for this character. And I found out about this from Giffen, who pointed it out. Said, I'm the model for that guy. And he pointed it out because he doesn't feel, and this is an interesting kind of position, that what he was doing, whatever it was, $80 million or not, that this was a matter of selfishness, that this was a matter of not serving the country. He sees it as serving the country because he was, does appear, working with the CIA as a conduit of information, passing things back and forth. And so Giffen agreed to go onto the record with some of the stuff. And so I, again, trying to bring forth some of the issues and the complexities. I go into his office, I describe his office, and I describe these discussions. And it's a way of trying to explain some of the complexities, because very often, again, with oil and kind of all these mysteries and questions, it's all about oil, it's not about oil, everything's corrupt, it's not corrupt at all, the war is about oil or not. We sometimes focus on one thing and not other things. And with this case, it showed to me that, you know, yes, you know, oil companies are involved in interesting transactions, shall we say. But there are portions of our government, at least, that are aware of them. And we want that oil cheaply. We want to get that oil. We want it under the control of American companies. So if we focus just on, you know, the guy who's been indicted or accused or convicted of bribery or whatever, then maybe we're missing part of the story, which involves us. Because we want our oil to be $2.50 a barrel, not $3 a gallon, not $3, not $3.50. And so I try to bring that alive to you know, the greatest extent that I possibly can. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I went to Saudi Arabia to focus on the question of oil supply. because it's another part of the invisibility that I wanted to bring around. There's this theory of peak oil, which is that the world actually is at the limit of the amount of oil that can be extracted. Oil reservoirs, reservoir may be even the wrong word to use, because they're not like big pools of oil underground where you just suck out as much as you want any period of time. Little bits of oil stuck between rocks, incredibly difficult to extract. And you can't just extract as much as you want when you want it. If you try too hard or use the wrong methods, you can damage a reservoir and kind of like seal oil down there that you won't ever be able to receive to extract. And so the peak oil theory is that actually Saudi Arabia and the other countries that have a lot of oil and say they'll be able to supply us with as much oil as we want in the future, therefore don't worry, keep using oil, maybe don't have as much and can't continue increasing the amount of oil they supply. And so I went to Saudi Arabia to try to find out how much oil do they really have, how much can they continue producing, can they keep increasing the amounts. And again, I'm pretty good at getting my foot in the door, but I go to Saudi Arabia and the oil minister refuses to see me. He refuses even to, you know, let an intern talk to me. I can't go into the oil ministry itself. And in the end, on my last day in Saudi Arabia, the minister's spokesman agrees to see me, but not at the ministry, at my hotel, just in the lobby for 20 minutes, during which he says to me, "You have to believe our numbers. We're not going to provide, nobody provides independent audited numbers. Nobody provides geological information. Trust us." And he said, "You know, look, I'm not asking to go count the number of dollar bills that the Fed has in its safes." And I'm like, "We don't have safes. That's not where we, you know," he knows that. And it just was another way, and I use that conversation to kind of bring out the issue of supply and how difficult it is to get at the truth. And you know, narratively, it's a story. There's this mystery, and I try to find people who can demonstrate it rather than just sticking with the numbers and the issues alone. And when I was in Saudi Arabia, I also tried to, when we're talking about the effects that oil can have on countries, and when we're talking about the curse issues, it's not just an economic issue. I mean, Saudi Arabia clearly has gotten wealthier as a result of its oil. A lot of countries that have oil, incomes have risen. But there are political effects. And one of the political effects that we're all very familiar with, obviously, is that a lot of the oil money that Saudi Arabia got went into funding Islamic extremism. And you know, one of the consequences of which is that 11 of the 15 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi. And I wanted to try to understand the relationship between men like that, who do things of that sort, and oil. And so I found a young Saudi who was 20 years old, who had become a jihadi, which is a fighter against America. And I actually found him not in Saudi Arabia. I found him in Iraq. I went back to Iraq several times after the invasion. And on one of my visits, I was in Samarra, which is a town in the Sunni Triangle, where this is 2005, the insurgency is roaring away. And I'm doing a story about Iraqi special police commandos who are kind of trying to fight against the insurgents. And I'm in Samarra, and there's Americans who are working with these Iraqi special police commandos, and one of the American advisors comes to me and says, "We just captured a Saudi. Do you want to interview him?" And that puts me in a very strange situation, because actually interviewing prisoners is a really ethically mushy area for journalists to do, because prisoners are in a situation of duress. And what they say isn't necessarily reliable, and you don't want to participate in kind of jeopardizing them further. But I agree to say yes, because this was an extraordinary, for me as a writer, somebody wanted to understand oil and terrorism, opportunity. And so they take me to the detention center in Samarra, which is used to be a library, now is a detention center. And which had an Arabic inscription over the top, which said something to the effect of, you know, "This is the house of knowledge," which is kind of ironic when it turns into a detention center. And when I enter, the first thing I start hearing are screams. And I can't see the screams. I mean, I can't see the people who are screaming, but they are the screams of terror. And I'm led into a little office, and there are two chairs in the office, and there's a desk, and there are bloodstains down the desk. And then this 20-year-old Saudi is brought in, his head is bandaged. And I just start asking him about his life. How old are you? 20 years old. Where are you from? Dahran. Where did you go to school? King Saud University. Did you finish? No. Why not? Because there were no jobs. I had no future. And this is one of the interesting things about oil that his narrative kind of revealed. And I try to explain these consequences through people's narratives. That oil, as much money as it brings into a country, it doesn't bring jobs. Oil is a capital-intensive industry. It's not a labor-intensive industry. And what that means is that you have kind of a sector that dominates the economy but doesn't put many people to work. And when it dominates the economy, for all kinds of very complicated macroeconomic effects that we all, including me, might fall asleep if I attempt to explain them here, oil makes it more difficult, if it's a dominant factor in the economy, for the agricultural and industrial sectors to thrive. So this youth, Muhammad, didn't have much of a prospect for work. Unemployment's a big problem in Saudi Arabia. It's a big problem in most oil countries that are dependent on oil. He didn't like the royal family. It's an absolute dictatorship. You know, there are no elections of any consequence in Saudi Arabia. And he became inspired as like purpose in his life by Islamic extremism. And so he joined a cell, and he ended up going to Syria and then being infiltrated into Iraq and then getting to Samarra as part of the cell and then getting caught before he could become a suicide bomber. And I ask him, sitting in that little room with the bloodstains down the desk and the screams and the retching that I'm hearing, you know, why do you think America is here? Why are you here? And he says, it's all about oil. America wants to have Iraq's oil. Now, we don't even have to believe that. We can believe we went there for democracy and for weapons of democracy, for weapons of mass destruction, and those were factors. But even if you don't believe that oil plays a role in all these things that we do, a lot of other people do, and there's a cost to that. One of the costs is that there are 20-year-olds like Muhammad who are going around trying to find Americans to kill. And I want to just finish by not being totally depressing. By saying that, you know, one of the problematic aspects of oil is the kind of concentration of power that it represents. You know, oil is not like fertile farmland that stretches from coast to coast that, you know, a lot of people work on and a lot of people own. It's concentrated. And so governments or royal families that possess it become super powerful. And they can become super corrupt. One of the ways to fight against that is transparency. And we talked about, I mentioned the invisibility thing. There are really interesting movements afoot now that some of you probably have heard of. One called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which is a government-led effort to try to have voluntary codes of conduct where companies that extract resources, particularly oil, but other resources too, publish the payments, and that the countries that receive it also publish what they receive. And there's another effort that's kind of going alongside it, a bit more aggressive, which is called Publish What You Pay, which is trying to make this obligatory by having laws that will require companies to publish every payment they make and require countries to publish what they pay. And then there's also a lot of efforts going on in these countries. Nigeria is a good example, where you have civic groups that are actually becoming much more active in trying to track the flow of money. And so that is something that kind of everybody can become involved in and can support, and that can actually have an effect, because the more that people can see the transactions of money, see where the money is, see what it is, the harder it becomes for people to steal it, and hopefully the harder it becomes to waste it on stupid projects, because nobody knows what the money's really being spent on. And then there's another form of transparency, which I think the Giffen case kind of relates to, which is political transparency on our side. You know, when Donald Rumsfeld said that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 had literally nothing to do with oil, that was really bad comedy. But I also kind of felt a little bit of sympathy for Rumsfeld, which is not a natural position for me or for most people in this country now, because it's impossible or very difficult for politicians to talk honestly about oil. Oil is part of that invasion. Oil is part of our support for dictatorships, all of these other countries, and yet it's denied totally, because to admit it is to say, you know, the jig is up. You know, we have blood in our gas tanks. But we need to kind of enable that discussion to take place so that we can know over here that, you know, yeah, that's right. You know, the oil in our gas tanks comes from these countries where there's dictatorship that's related to the oil. comes from these countries where there's conflict that's related to the oil, and we're making compromises for it. Our government is making compromises for it. Our government is, to one extent or the other, maybe invading a country for it. And so we need to kind of be able to have that discussion and let politicians be honest about it without shouting them down at the first instant. So that's kind of where I want to end it right now, on this hopeful note of transparency. And, you know, part of the transparency hopefully also is going to be the questions and the discussion that we have now. Thank you very much.
Peter, thank you very much. I just want to remind the radio listeners that I'm Robert Collier, and we're talking with Peter Maas, the author of Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Now, we've got a lot of wonderful questions on these blue cards, and a lot of them actually dovetail with the ending of your remarks about looking forward to solutions. And we got a lot of questions, several of them from students who are here from the Oakland Emiliano Zapata Street Academy and the Phil and Sal Burton Academic High School here in San Francisco, who asked, what can we do about the ethical problems of the oil business? And one even asked, what kind of gas should we buy? Are any of them not bloody?
That's a great question, because, you know, with, for example, Nike tennis shoes, there was a controversy many years ago about sweatshops where Nike tennis shoes were made. And so Nike was kind of made to improve the conditions at the factories in Southeast Asia and elsewhere where its shoes were made. The situation with diamonds, there was a controversy over blood diamonds because diamonds were fomenting conflict in some countries, particularly in Africa. And actually now there's kind of codes of conduct where conflict diamonds are not supposed to be bought or sold by companies, and that's kind of working out. And the problem with oil is that, first off, companies become scared when they're selling luxury products like Nike shoes or diamonds that they know that consumers can live without. And so it's a problem with oil because consumers can't live without oil. We need to fill up our tanks with gasoline. And another problem is that we don't know at the pump where the gasoline comes from, because oil companies don't really want us to know where it comes from. And it is difficult to actually kind of source that information, but it is possible. You can find out, and some investigative reporters have. A guy named Paul Salopek for the Chicago Tribune wrote a wonderful series about 2 years ago, tracing kind of the gasoline from his local gas station to the countries it came from. And so one of the things that can happen, and I've been talking with some NGOs about this recently, because they're beginning to focus on it, is trying to identify the sources of oil from the country of origin to the pumps where people buy it. So people know, aha, you know, the oil comes from Nigeria, the oil comes from Kazakhstan, the oil comes from wherever it comes from. The problem with that whole thing is, first we'll have to find out, if you do identify that oil in the tank is from Nigeria or some other place, are people really going to care? We'll have to see about that. And then there's another problem, which is that pretty much all of the oil in the world has some price tag attached to it that relates to the environment. Canada supplies us, actually, is our largest supplier of oil. Very democratic country, no corruption. But a lot of that oil is from tar sands, which is kind of a very difficult form of oil. In order to kind of get the oil out of it, you have to use a lot of water, you have to actually use a lot of energy, you have to burn the earth practically to get the oil out of it and wash the oil out. There's an environmental cost to that. So kind of every country that oil comes from, in a sense, has a different interesting problem associated with it. And so we should know kind of what the problems are with the oil that's in our gas tank, but then we also have to realize that probably wherever the oil comes from, there is going to be some issue related to it. And that kind of gets at the whole idea of, well, all the more reason, in addition to global warming, you know, in addition to hopefully not invading countries anymore, understanding that because there's not kind of like a pure great source of oil, that maybe we need to really, really, really step it up and really kind of make a lot more progress in terms of becoming more active on environmental issues, making people aware that, you know, oil has all kinds of costs, and we therefore have to move much quicker to kind of develop conservation efficiency, alternative energy, build power grids, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm a writer. My skill, if I have it, is to just write about what I see and then bring it to people and then let people do what they can with it. Use it for awareness, use it for education, and use it for developing programs or whatever, but I'm not the program guy. And I'm not a good wonk either. But I just think that my job as a writer is to kind of give you the information that I come across in a compelling way, and then you use it. And that's what, you know, Rob does in his work, and so many other writers do too.
So there are no brands of gas that are any less bloody than the others?
Well, they're different. There's some that, I mean, look, gas that comes from Mexico is not bloody, okay? There's no war going on there. There's a lot of corruption and things of that sort. There are real development problems in Mexico. There are political problems in terms of, you know, full democracy, et cetera. But no, I mean, Venezuela, for example, is a country where, you know, now there's a regime in place that represents more kind of the aspirations of the poor people who haven't benefited enough from oil before. But actually, in Venezuela, environmentally, there are tremendous problems with the oil that comes out of the ground in terms of the national oil company not doing it in a very environmentally safe way. So they're just different prices. It's not all blood. Some of it is, you know, environmental despoilation. You know, the oil that comes from Ecuador is very problematic. I've been to Ecuador. I went to the area that the oil comes from. And it's a terribly devastated area environmentally. So California gets a lot of its oil from Ecuador. And one of the ironies is that during the 1970s and 1980s, when California itself was becoming much more environmentally conscious, cleaning up our coastlines, banning offshore oil, you know, we were getting oil from this country that was suffering enormously environmentally because of it. We couldn't see it. It was invisible. Reporters weren't writing about it enough. Maybe it wasn't known well enough. And so, you know, there's always some problem with it, which is one of the reasons we need to become more aware of what the problems are, because then hopefully that will give us added impulsion to go in the directions we need to go.
You mentioned Ecuador. There's been a fair amount of attention recently to a court case in an Ecuadorian court in which Ecuadorians are suing Chevron for Texaco's pollution in Ecuador in the 1980s and 90s. And one of the questioners asks, what would happen if the court rules against Chevron? What will be the impact of that? And do you think there's much of a chance of a ruling against Chevron?
Well, it's a really interesting situation because Texaco for 20 years was extracting oil from Ecuador, and according to the lawsuit, which is just about to reach a verdict in Ecuador, tremendous amount of environmental damage was caused. Wastewater was just poured into the rivers. There were pits of oil that were not lined with cement or plastic, so the oil seeped down into the aquifer and poisoned the water that people were drinking and that the plants were growing off of. And so this case began in 1993 in a court in San Francisco, and it's taken until now, 2009, what are we talking, 16 years, for it to reach the point where there's going to be a verdict in Ecuador. And the verdict is probably going to go against Chevron, and it's probably going to be in the multi-billions of dollars. An expert hired by the court has estimated the damages are $27 billion. Whether the court will totally assess that amount, we don't know. But the thing is, it's still going to take, even if the court decides that, a number of years for appeals to also work themselves out. And so one of the problems with these cases where there has been environmental damage, if you accept the court's verdict, is that actually it takes a tremendously long time for the justice system to work through it and actually award damages. The Exxon Valdez accident occurred, 15 years ago or something like that. There was a verdict against Exxon in an Alaskan court 14 years ago, and Exxon appealed it, which is its right. Appealed it for a very long time, a $5 billion judgment, and just this year, actually, finally, the Supreme Court ruled that they'd have to pay $500 million. Something like 25 or 40% of the original class action plaintiffs have already died. So a verdict in Ecuador will certainly have an effect, but it's not going to revolutionize it, because what's been shown is that it pays for companies to appeal. It pays for companies to draw these things out as long as they can. And it is their right to do that. And the system is just very slow to kind of operate and offer justice in cases where justice is due. So it doesn't say that the verdict, if it happens against Chevron, will not be effective. But it's not perhaps going to be as effective as one would want it to be, or as immediate in terms of impact as one might want it to be.
Peter, in your book, you mentioned briefly a few countries that are doing pretty well by oil, Norway and the United Arab Emirates. Could you talk a bit more about this?
Well, Norway, of course, is a wonderful Scandinavian country that found a lot of oil and natural gas in its waters in the North Sea. 20, 30 years ago. And it had the virtue, Norway, and this is why it's so successful, of having found democracy before it found oil. Because, and it's true, because it had these institutions that were open, that were democratic, so that A, the country could decide democratically, openly, without violence, whatever, who owns the oil and gas, the revenues, and how they should be used. So you didn't have a war breaking out as you did in Nigeria, or you didn't have a dictator as you do in Equatorial Guinea deciding that, well, pretty much he owns the oil. And so you had A, an open system where people decided through a parliamentary democracy, et cetera, this is how we're going to use the oil. And they had established civic institutions that were resistant to corruption, to the temptations to steal. So you did not have the oil money that was coming in being taken by corrupt officials. And you also had, as a result of this open democratic system and discussions, a decision that was key, which was, you know, all this oil money and all this natural gas money that we're getting, we're not going to spend it. In fact, we're not going to even save it in our own country, in our own banks. We're going to invest it offshore so that our economy isn't deformed by this just wave of money. And it takes a lot of discipline to do that, to say, okay, this bounty of money that's coming in, we're not going to spend it. We're going to save it for future generations. It's a very hard thing for countries to do, particularly poor countries, because they feel like we have this money, we need to spend it now. And the actual spending of it becomes a problem because they don't have the capacity to do it well, let alone the corruption problems. So Norway is kind of like an outlier because it had democracy, a very strong democracy, before it found oil. Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, et cetera, did not. And other countries like the United Arab Emirates, Brunei, Kuwait, have a different sort of outlier position, which is they have a tremendous amount of oil on a per capita basis. A lot of oil, very few people. So it's virtually kind of impossible, almost, for those countries to not see dramatic increases in standards of living, because there is so much oil. The royal family in Kuwait can take pretty much whatever it wants. There's still going to be enough left over for everybody else. And that's a different situation than countries like Nigeria, than countries like Iraq, than countries like Iran, which have a lot of oil, have more oil than Kuwait does, or United Arab Emirates, but they also have a lot of people. And the amount of oil they have cannot lift everybody out of poverty the way it does in those small countries that have a lot of reserves.
China is becoming a big oil power, and Chinese oil companies are scouring the world for oil to feed its economy. Africa, for example. Are Chinese oil companies any better or any worse than American oil companies?
Well, they're certainly, to begin with, there. When I was in Equatorial Guinea, the place where I got kicked out after 8 days, I kind of confronted the Chinese presence roundabout way, which was I was staying in this hotel, and there were two ways to pay my bill. This is before I got expelled. It was either by paying cash, which is, I carry a lot of cash, but I needed to conserve it because the country at the time was kind of off the grid. I could not pay the credit card. Either cash, or I could pay my hotel bill into a bank account that was in Shanghai. And light bulb kind of went off over Peter Moss's dim brain, because the hotel was called the Dynasty Hotel, and the people working behind the reception were Chinese, and the food, this is in this little West African country, that was being served in the hotel restaurant was Chinese. It was owned by a Chinese company. There were roads that were being built in Equatorial Guinea by Chinese companies. There are Chinese companies that were bidding for and getting some contracts in Equatorial Guinea, as they are throughout Africa particularly, because of the resources that it has. So there is this kind of new great race going on for resources, which are scarce, particularly oil, between the United States and China, which is kind of, in my mind, in some ways true, but also an excuse, because it's easy for American companies and the American government to say, look, you know, we're competing now against China. We have to do whatever it takes to get these resources. So that's why we have to, you know, be in bed with the dictator of Equatorial Guinea or Kazakhstan, because if we're not doing it, the Chinese will, and then they're going to win. And they also say, when I was in Ecuador, there was a part of the Amazon in Ecuador, in the south, that is still kind of virgin. I went there, beautiful, you know, just nothing but forest and clear streams, and I stayed with an indigenous tribe there for a couple of days. Oil companies want to go in there because it's believed there's a lot of oil there. And when I was in Quito, after having been in this beautiful area where the local people that I stayed with were trying to keep the oil companies at bay, I met with an American oilman, and he said, look, you know, these people might not want us to come in there, but there's oil there. The world needs oil. Somebody is going to end up going in there. And it's better if it's us going in there than the Chinese or the Russians, because A, our technology is better, which is true. And therefore, there will be less environmental destruction. And B, ethically, we're better. We'll have better kind of local social programs, et cetera. And both of those things may be true. I mean, it's certainly true that American companies and Western companies have better technology than Chinese companies do at this point. And it's also true that on paper, ethically, American companies have better standards and the laws against corruption, et cetera, are stronger here than they are in China. But as I saw throughout the world, what exists on paper doesn't always exist in fact. And, you know, the behavior of American companies in Equatorial Guinea to me did not seem to be something to celebrate. And so it appeared to me that for people like this executive, kind of the prospect of Chinese companies as our competitors was really useful, because it was kind of a justification for allowing this area to be extracted by American companies, justifying the extraction itself. And I just kind of thought that, you know, the problem isn't us against the Chinese, or it shouldn't be us against the Chinese. You know, we should realize that, like, if that's the direction we're going, you know, then we're going to have this race to the bottom. We're going to have more environmental harm, ethical problems, et cetera. That actually, the lesson we should take from this Chinese threat, if you want to refer to it as that, is that we should go in a different direction. Instead of kind of pushing for more extraction in the Amazon, et cetera, let's push even harder for the different paths, the conservation, the efficiency, et cetera. So, you know, it's a new issue, and the Chinese are there, and they're competing. And the thing is, too, that do we have more of a right to Africa's oil than the Chinese do? And the answer probably is no. So, you know, do we get involved in this race all over again, or do we try to find different ways to kind of live and live together?
We have time for just one more question and a brief response at that. Is gasoline and is the oil industry just another exploitative, extractive industry like gold, like silver, like diamonds, like old growth timber, or is it inherently different in terms of the damage it does and the effects it has?
It's a great question. I mean, these are all extractive industries, and the word itself tells you a lot. I mean, it's extractive. You go into the earth, you gouge the earth, and even the most kind of environmentally conscious gold mining, silver mining, oil extraction is going to cause damage. And so there's a commonality that they all have with each other. The particularity of oil is that, you know, A, the amount of money that can be made is so much vaster. I mean, all you need is that contract, and you're kind of guaranteed a profit. And so the race for the contracts creates an enormous amount of corruption, or it can create an enormous amount of corruption. And B, oil is absolutely essential. And so we must have it. The regimes that possess it want to extract it. And the kind of, you know, inherent wealth of these oil fields is just so much greater than a gold mine here or there or a silver mine here or there, that it becomes a dominant force in a way that, you know, gold, silver, copper do not become. And it's this concentration. You know, it's like a democracy of commodities. You know, democracy is great in just so many ways, and democracy is great in an economic way too. You don't want to have reliance on this one substance. You don't want to have all the country's wealth or the preponderance of the country's wealth in this one substance. And that's one of the problems of oil, is that it is so valuable. In some countries, it exists in such large amounts that it becomes an undemocratic economic situation in a way. And you know, as in politics, also in economy, that tends to be an unhealthy situation.
Well, this has been really fascinating time. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And I'm Robert Collier, and on behalf of the World Affairs Council, the Asia Society, and the Mechanics Institute Library, I'd like to thank Peter Moss for providing us with all your thoughts and insights about your great book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And Peter will be staying afterward to sign copies of his book. So I'd urge you all to take advantage of this opportunity. So thanks very much, and good night.
Thank you.